Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jeanette Jalil, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 25th of July, these are our main stories. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has admitted that his government didn't understand the nature of the coronavirus in the early weeks and months of the pandemic. The US authorities say a Singaporean man has pleaded guilty to working as a Chinese agent as tensions between the two superpowers continue to grow. Dozens of journalists have resigned from Hungary's leading independent news website, claiming that the government is attempting to destroy it. Also in this podcast...
It's a beautiful sunny morning in Kapsasiua, Nandi Hills, in the Rift Valley. All around me there are tea farms and there's maize to my right, livestock. It's a typical Kenyan village, but with a troubled history.
We examine the effects of colonialism in Kenya and how memories remain of those who were punished for opposing it. Here in Britain, more than 45,000 people have died with coronavirus, the highest death toll in Europe. Yet up until Friday, the government insisted that the correct decisions had been taken at the correct time. Now the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has admitted that the government didn't understand the coronavirus in its first few weeks and months. In a BBC interview, Mr. Johnson also said there were very open questions about whether lockdown had been imposed too late. Our political editor, Laura Koonsberg, reports.
Boris Johnson's been reluctant to confront what the government has got wrong during the pandemic. The right decisions were made at the right time was the familiar mantra. However, as he marked a year in office, the Prime Minister inched towards acknowledging some specific mistakes, suggesting the government's initial assumptions about the virus were behind the curve.
Everybody can see that this was something that was new, that we didn't understand in the way that we would have liked in the first few weeks and months. And I think probably, you know, the single thing that we didn't see at the beginning was the extent to which it was being transmitted asymptomatically from person to person. That wasn't clear to us or to anybody.
The government's expectation had been that the peak of the disease would be around the end of May, but the spread of the virus was faster. Boris Johnson now concedes the initial response may have been too slow.
I think it's fair to say that there are things that we need to learn about how we handled it in the early stages. And I've mentioned one thing in particular, but I think what people really want to focus on now is what are we doing to prepare for the next phase.
And on the most fundamental issue, whether the lockdown came too late, the Prime Minister accepted that while he'd stuck to government scientists' advice like glue, perhaps that advice had been wrong.
When you listen to the scientists, the questions that you have just asked are actually very open questions as far as they are concerned. And there will be a time, obviously, to consider all those issues.
After years of dreaming of the top job, Boris Johnson's 366 days in office have been full of agonies for him and, more importantly, for the country. Times that he could simply not have imagined. For a politician whose trademark is optimism, the lesson is, perhaps, that the real challenge of life in power is surprise.
Laura Koonsberg. Well, I spoke to our political correspondent, Rob Watson. So, was this a change in tone from Boris Johnson?
Yes and no, Jeanette. I mean, in many ways, I thought this was rather classic Boris Johnson. I mean, there is at no point in this long interview with our colleague Laura Koonsberg an apology. It's classic Johnson, never apologise, never explain. I mean, Laura Koonsberg, the BBC's political editor, she said that Boris Johnson inched towards acknowledging mistakes were made. But, I mean, he sort of meant mistakes more in terms of the entire world. We, the world, didn't understand the virus. So I thought in many ways it's classic Boris Johnson not admitting really that mistakes were made.
But he did concede that there were lessons to be learnt, including the timing of the lockdown.
He certainly did. But again, I mean, it seemed to me, looking quite carefully at the words the Prime Minister chose, I mean, he didn't say that the UK was ill-prepared, that it hadn't done the testing properly, that it had struggled to get protective equipment. And to the extent that there was a mistake made in the timing of the lockdown, again, he seemed to be a attributing that as much to the scientific advice that the government was receiving, the uncertainty of the advice, the contradictions there, as opposed to any mistakes that he or any ministers might have made.
And like many other leaders, Boris Johnson has faced an unexpected challenge in dealing with the pandemic. It's been a remarkable first year for him in power.
It has, and I guess you would say, to borrow a football, it has been a game of two halves. I mean, the first 6 months were extraordinary. I mean, you have to remember the Conservative Party under Theresa May was in disarray, floundering in the polls. She couldn't deliver on her government's pledge to leave the European Union with a deal. It looked as though it was all over for the Conservative Party. He came along, turned it all round, won the most astonishing general election victory in December. Huge majority, managed to get Britain out of the EU as he promised at the end of January. But I mean, of course, since then, everything has looked very, very difficult indeed with the virus. But he's still standing and, you know, in many ways, his approval ratings are holding up remarkably well.
Rob Watson. The US Justice Department says a Singaporean man has pleaded guilty in a federal court to working as an illegal agent of the Chinese government. Jun Wei Yeo, also known as Dixon Yeo, was charged with using his political consultancy in the US as a front to collect information for Chinese intelligence. This comes amid a growing confrontation between Washington and Beijing in recent days that's included the US ordering China to shut its consulate in Houston. In response, China has ordered the closure of the US consulate in the city of Chengdu. Our State Department correspondent, Barbara Plett-Usher, told Julia Marshall more about the reasons for the US closing the Chinese consulate in Houston.
The senior administration officials basically said that all the consulates are bases for espionage and a certain amount of spycraft is expected in foreign missions. But Houston was one of the worst offenders of the Chinese consulates, and its activity went well over the line of what was acceptable. So they decided to shut that one down when they wanted to send a broad message that enough was enough. They did give some details about activity in Houston. They linked the espionage actions there to China's pursuit of research into a vaccine for the new coronavirus, not with a great deal of detail, but they did make that connection. They also said that the Houston consulate was particularly aggressive in promoting plans to recruit talent at local research centers, which can then serve as a conduit to offer incentives to steal intellectual property. And they mentioned that this was actually quite an organized program, the dimensions of which they'd only begun to become aware of in the past 3 years. So that was roughly the gist of it.
And the Chinese researcher who took refuge in the country's San Francisco consulate to avoid visa fraud charges has been arrested, I understand.
That's right. She had sought refuge in the San Francisco consulate on charges of visa fraud, but we were told, it was confirmed, that she'd been arrested. We didn't get any detail about how that happened, but we were told that they believed she could stand trial, that she didn't have diplomatic immunity because she didn't have diplomatic status. The whole issue of the visa fraud was that she had misrepresented herself as somebody who was just a civilian. She's apparently, according to the State Department, a member of the military, but that doesn't give her any exemption in terms of trial.
So where is this all going, Barbara? Is the expectation that things are going to escalate, or maybe that they will calm down in the coming days?
Well, I think you can go a number of ways on that. But if you look at the Chinese response, it was not seen as an escalation, shutting down the consulate in Chengdu. It was sort of a medium move. They could have shut down the consulate in Wuhan, which was less important, but they could also have shut down a consulate in Hong Kong, which was more important. So they kind of chose a medium route and made very clear that they were responding to U.S. action. And so I think the message sent there was that they weren't looking for further escalation. I think also, you know, President Trump, although he has whipped up his rhetoric recently by putting China into his election campaign, also doesn't want any kind of serious confrontation, certainly not military one. But having said that, I was speaking to a former administration official yesterday, and he said, what's different is that the buffer that we used to have, which is that we had this common assumption that the purpose was de-escalation and sort of cooperation, that seems to have eroded. So if you don't have that buffer anymore, and you've got this sort of tensions, but no way to kind of bridge them, then you could have an accidental conflict. And I think that's concerning to people.
Barbara Plett-Usher in Washington. President Trump has signed executive orders aimed at reducing the price of prescription drugs, which has long been a worry for many Americans. Aline McBull has more.
The executive order that would potentially have the biggest impact would see a cap on drug prices in the US market in line with what pharmaceutical companies make on those drugs abroad, with the suggestion that could mean higher drug prices for other nations. This proposal, though, the president said would be put on hold for a month while drug companies suggest other ways prices could be controlled. He has, though, signed an order allowing drugs to be imported from countries like Canada and one that will bring down the cost of insulin in the US. These proposals don't go as far as he'd once promised they would in bringing down the often exorbitant cost of medicines in the US.
Aline McBull. Now to Hungary. Thousands of Hungarians protested on Friday in defence of press freedom as anger grew over the sacking of the editor of a leading independent news website, Index. More than 70 journalists and staff resigned after demanding that the former editor-in-chief, Szabolcs Gyula, be reinstated to his post. The government of Viktor Orbán is accused of trying to destroy the organisation. Here's Nick Thorpe in Budapest.
Almost the entire staff of Index handed in their resignations on Friday. They said the firing earlier this week of editor-in-chief Szabolcs Gyula meant they could no longer present the impartial, critical view of Hungary, free of political interference, which made Index so popular. The site received 1 million page reads a day. Magyar Nemzet, the flagship daily of Viktor Orbán's Fidesz party, attacked Index as a left-wing organ and explained its disappearance as the result of internal tensions, the same reasons given by the managing director for sacking the editor.
Nick Thorpe in Hungary. Now to Kenya, and one of the lesser-known legacies of colonialism is how those who dared to speak out about the foreign entities which ruled were punished. In the Rift Valley, the Talai, who are part of the Kalenjin ethnic community, were punished for opposing British settlement more than a century ago. The BBC's Anne Soy travelled to her birthplace in the Great Rift Valley to meet members of the Talai who still remain ostracised and impoverished because of colonial propaganda.
It's a beautiful sunny morning in Kapsasiua, Nandi Hills, in the Rift Valley. All around me there are tea farms and there's maize to my right, livestock. It's a typical Kenyan village, but with a troubled history. This was a detention camp during colonial days. The farm I'm walking around ends at a river, and that was the physical boundary for the Talai clan that were detained here by the colonial government. They were the Laibons, or the traditional leaders of the Kalenjin, the third largest ethnic group in Kenya.
The Laibon Removal Ordinance.
The Laibon Removal Ordinance was signed in London and Nairobi and used to detain our clan here to end its influence on the community.
80-year-old Reverend Canon James Bassey chairs the clan's Council of Elders. His forefathers led one of the fiercest anti-colonial resistance movements in East Africa. When the British settlers arrived at the turn of the century, Koitalel Arap Samoe was the leader of the clan and the community. He opposed their settlement and waged a 15-year war. Eventually, the colonial administration invited him for peace talks. But when he presented himself together with his entire cabinet, they were all executed.
My great-grandfather, Koitalel Samoe, was assassinated at 11 a.m.
I met David Sule, Koitalel's great-grandson, outside the mausoleum built in honour of the resistance leader. He says his great-grandfather arrived to meet Colonel Menetshagen holding a grass which was a sign of peace.
But Colonel Menetshagen had to shoot him, and he was calling for a peace conference. So we were so bitterly, actually, I was killed.
But his clan, the Talai, continued to lead the resistance, and so the colonial rulers used every means possible to quash it.
The settlers used divide and rule tactics. They turned the community against us. They convinced them that the Talai were evil people. You see, they had guns and bombs, and all we had were arrows and spears. And we fought against them for more than 10 years. So they said we were evil.
The Talai were revered among the Kalenjin. They still are. It was and still is believed that they have supernatural powers to foretell events. To the community, they were prophets. But that religion was at odds with what the European Christian missionaries introduced. It is recorded that some of the early converts were sent by the colonial administrators to spy on the clan's elders. They were taught that the clan was evil, that they practiced witchcraft. As more and more people turned to Christianity, they wanted nothing to do with the Talai. The resistance was broken. And for over a century, that tag has stuck. Even the Talai who became Christians were unable to shed it, including their chairman, Reverend Canon James Bassey, who is an ordained minister of the Anglican Church.
Even when I preach in churches, you'll still find people gossiping. But he is a Laiboni from the evil clan. If a misfortune befalls people we have interacted with, we are accused of causing it.
As a Kalenjin, I've heard these rumors before. I asked some members of my community what they thought of the Talai. Their responses have been voiced by actors.
We rarely talk about them in the public. They are mostly associated with supernatural things and believed by many to be the eyes of the gods.
I'm scared of that clan. I was told if you mess up with them, they can kill you or make you insane. I have not met one and wouldn't be happy to be hosted by them.
It was a useful political tool for the colonial rulers. It paved the way for settlers to take over productive land in the Rift Valley. The Talai were detained and ostracized. It's been recorded that some of their sons took part in the world wars, and on return to Kenya, they were taken back to the detention camps.
We were very hopeful when we got independence. We were happy that the rest of Kenya had finally realized what the Nandi resistance was all about. But we did not get anything. When land was being subdivided among the locals, we asked for some, but we got nothing. They said we were the Laibons, the evil ones.
The Talai clan say they were failed by consecutive governments since independence. They've continued to live in the shadows, shunned by the community they once ruled. For them, this is the lasting legacy of colonialism.
That report by Anne Soy in Kenya.
Also in the podcast,
the two doctors, Yoshikazu Okubo and Naoki Yamamoto, they stand accused of administering the lethal dose at the woman's home.
Investigators in Japan are looking into whether two doctors ended the life of a woman with a long-term illness in exchange for payment. European countries were hardest hit at the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic in spring, but after months of lockdown, they had been cautiously hoping the worst was over. Now, with restrictions eased, some countries are seeing a worrying resurgence of the disease and are taking steps to respond. Jonathan Savage reports.
Things have been relatively stable across Europe for the past 2 months at around 20,000 infections a day, well down on April's peak. But spikes in new cases are prompting governments to take action. France is concerned about numbers rising at home, but also abroad. It's urging its citizens not to travel at all to the Catalonia region of Spain. There, nearly 8,000 cases were diagnosed in the 14 days up to Thursday, almost half of the 16,410 detected throughout the country. That's despite guidelines for residents of regional capital Barcelona to stay at home. A Catalan government source responded, saying they have stricter regulations in force than the rest of Europe, including France. The French government has also announced mandatory coronavirus tests for travellers from 16 countries outside the European Union, including the United States, Turkey and Morocco. Prime Minister Jean Castex explained why.
For l'ensemble de ces pays, il a été décidé.
For all these countries, it has been decided that passengers will be required to have a test certifying that they do not carry the virus in order to board the corresponding aircraft. We know that in a number of these countries, there is no screening strategy, and therefore access to testing is difficult. As a result, we have decided to carry out testing on arrival, and this is what is being put in place.
Spain is worried too. On Thursday, it reported nearly 1,000 new cases in the previous 24 hours, the highest number since lockdown was eased last month. Another country seeing more cases is Poland, with an increase to the total of 458, the highest since mid-June. Its government said it had no plans to introduce a lockdown in response, blaming the spike on a cluster of cases around coal mines in the Upper Silesia region.
Jonathan Savage. Investigators in Japan are looking into whether two doctors gave a lethal dose of a drug to a woman with a long-term illness in exchange for payment. The doctors have been arrested, and it's emerged that they received more than $12,000 in bank transfers from the woman. I heard more from our reporter, Will Leonardo.
It's a very tragic case. The two doctors, Yoshikazu Okubo and Naoki Yamamoto, they stand accused of administering the lethal dose at the woman's home in November, apparently at her request. The woman was called Yuri Hayashi. She's 51 years old, and she'd been diagnosed with a severe form of motor neurone disease known as ALS, a mostly incurable illness. Basically, your muscle function decreases and leads to paralysis. After their alleged visit, she was taken ill and rushed to hospital and died, and a medicine that she doesn't normally take was found inside her body. Investigators say now that they've established that the trio had been in contact with each other beforehand, and bank transfers, as you were saying, of more than $12,000 had been made into one of the doctors' accounts. The doctors are in detention on contract killing charges, but police have yet to say how they'll plead.
So a shocking case. What's the reaction been to it in Japan?
Yes, well, I mean, the reaction, there's been, as you say, a level of shock to it, especially as there's been drip feeds of information that have been coming out for more about this doctor, including the fact that he had written a blog saying that he'd wanted to help elderly people take their own lives, saying that life become tough for many. And as you remember, Japan is one of the oldest populations in the world. And also his wife, Pat Strangely, held a press conference today saying that her husband had himself tried to take his own life. All of this has fed into the wider debate about euthanasia in Japan, which is a bit of a grey area. Previous cases of doctors helping their patients to die have led to convictions, but their cases did establish some form of legal framework for euthanasia. But in this case, as we've been mentioning, the woman did not appear to be near the end of her life, per se, and the doctors stand accused of receiving some form of money. So for supporters of the discussion about euthanasia, this might hamper their cause in a way.
Because this has shed a light not just on attitudes towards euthanasia, but attitudes towards disabled people.
Absolutely. And this is kind of a key topic in Japan. You know that the Paralympics were due to start this shortly, and there was kind of hope that this would shine a light on how the disabled consider a certain taboo in the country. But things are changing. Last year, two severely disabled people were elected to Japan's parliament for the first time. One, the upper house legislator Yasuhiko Funago, who also has motor neurone disease, the same as the woman in this case, said in response to this week's story that society should protect the right to live and not the right to die.
Will Leonardo. As we heard in an earlier podcast, Friday was meant to have been the opening of the 2020 Tokyo Olympics, but they've been postponed by exactly a year because of the pandemic. That 12-month delay presents a huge challenge to the athletes who are timing their peak performances for this summer. But athletic form is not the only thing that's in danger of fading if the COVID crisis hasn't disappeared. The host nation's enthusiasm for holding the Games has already plummeted, and a growing number of Japanese people doubt that the Games will ever take place. From Tokyo, Rupert Wingfield-Hayes reports.
That sound you can hear behind me is Tetsu jumping high up on a giant trampoline. I'm inside a very rudimentary gymnasium in the north of Tokyo. It's really like a big old factory building with two giant trampolines inside it. And Tetsu is going way, way up, high up towards the ceiling.
Tetsu Sotomura was one of Japan's best trampolinists. At Beijing in 2008, he just missed out on the medals. Now at 35, Tokyo 2020 was going to be his last hurrah. But Tetsu has had enough. Another year is just too much. Back in 2008, if the Beijing Games had been postponed by a year, I would have thought, OK, he tells me. It's another year to train. But now I'm 35. A year feels like a long time. So I've decided retirement is the only option. But there is another reason Tetsuya is retiring. He thinks Tokyo 2021 may never happen. If what awaits us next year is cancellation, I would have lost another year for nothing, he says. So that's another reason to go now. Enthusiasm for the Games here has plummeted since COVID-19 arrived in Japan in January. An opinion poll done by the Kyodo News Agency this week found just 23% of Japanese now support holding the Games if COVID infections are still widespread next year.
I've come down now to what should be the Olympic Village, a series of shiny new apartment buildings on the waterfront in Tokyo Bay. It's a rather forlorn-looking ghost town with metal fences and do not enter signs. What happens to this place a year from now? If COVID-19 is still circulating, if there still isn't a widely available vaccine, then how on earth do you bring 10,000 athletes here to live together, to eat together, to compete together, and to do so safely?
From Brazil to India, South Africa to the United States, COVID infections are accelerating. And medical experts like Professor Kentaro Iwata at Kobe University think there is little chance the pandemic will be over by next summer.
COVID-19 is not likely to disappear by next year. So the next hope is a vaccine. That could be a game changer. But unlike the other strong vaccines such as smallpox, I don't think it is that powerful to eradicate the virus from the earth.
This Olympic promotional video shows crowds of joyful people flocking to Tokyo from all over the world. If that can't happen next year, then one seemingly simple solution is to push the Tokyo Games back to 2022. But that has been ruled out by the Japanese government. From his home in Montreal, the longest-serving member of the International Olympic Committee, Dick Pound, told me it is now 2021 or bust.
What we do know is that 2021 is the last chance. To the extent that it's safe for the athletes to come, I think every effort will be made to see the games going forward. But if the public health authorities conclude that it's just not safe enough, there's probably no alternative but to say, well, a pandemic is the new war.
What Dick Pound means is the only times the Olympics have been cancelled before was during the two world wars. And one of those was, you guessed it, Tokyo in 1940. It's hard to believe it could happen again because of COVID. But without a vaccine or some drastic change in the pandemic, many here think that is now the most likely outcome.
Rupert Wingfield Hayes in Japan. And the coronavirus pandemic has also led to Formula One scrapping this season's races in the Americas. The organisers say they decided not to go ahead with races in the US, Canada, Mexico and Brazil because of the high infection rates in the region. Our sports news correspondent is Alex Capstick. He told me the decision had not come as a surprise.
No, not at all. The rates of infection in the US and Brazil are the highest in the world. Both countries reporting over 1,000 deaths from COVID-19 a day. The number of cases also on the rise in Mexico. So this always seemed likely, even prudent, that the entire America's leg of the season would be cancelled. Things not as bad in Canada, but there are lots of restrictions in place there, especially over travel. So any hopes of that going ahead have been abandoned. That was supposed to have taken place earlier in the year, in June, but it was postponed, but now it won't go ahead at all.
So a big loss for the Americas, but Europe's game.
Yes, and Formula One organisers have moved quickly to lessen the impact, certainly in terms of the overall number of races. Three Grand Prix have been added to the schedule, all in Europe. They are at Imola in San Marino. That's an infamous track because it's where Ayrton Senna was killed in 1994. It'll be the first time Formula One has visited that circuit since 2006. The Nürburgring in Germany makes a return to the calendar for the first time in 7 years. And the Portimão track on the Algarve in southern Portugal will host its first ever Formula One weekend, with the possibility of fans being allowed to attend that race, adding to the excitement. So that brings the total number of Grand Prix to 13. They hope to end the season in the Middle East with two races in Bahrain and one in Abu Dhabi. That's in mid-December. In between, there could be a race in Vietnam. That was postponed earlier in the year in Hanoi, hoping to make its debut, and also possibly one in Malaysia. So they could get 17 or 18 Grand Prix, and that's probably much more than many people would have expected earlier in the year.
What are the financial implications of all this?
It's what has driven this whole new schedule by Formula One bosses. They could have just scrapped the whole season and said it's not going to work, but they worked really hard to make it safe and secure for the riders and their teams, all the people involved in putting a Grand Prix race. And obviously no fans are allowed in all of the venues so far, possibly one in Russia and maybe in Portugal, as I've just mentioned, but no fans so far. And that is because there are huge financial losses if these races don't go ahead. Hosts pay a handsome sum of money to stage these races. For example, in Baku, that's in Azerbaijan, that's been cancelled. That is worth around $60 million to Formula One. So they're desperate to get these races on.
Alex Capstick. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
I could just hear the metal being crushed and glass shattering, and it was so, so violent.
The Outlook podcast from the BBC World Service brings you tales of ordinary people with extraordinary stories.
An average person would take around a month to shed their skin, and I shed mine in a day.
When I got to the age of 9 years old, I decided, you know what, I had enough, so I make a run for the streets.
They lined us up against the wall with their machine guns, and they said, we're going to splatter your blood against this wall like paint.
And then suddenly, I was like, wait a minute, I can't live like this for the rest of my life.
I thought, you know what? No one can tell me I'm not allowed to talk about this.
I've been dying for 19 years. For me, it was worth the shot.
There was nothing that was going to stop me.
The Outlook podcast.
If you live every day like it's your last day, you take as much as you can of it. You don't care about the consequences.
Just search for BBC Outlook, wherever you get your podcasts.